Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HR Latte, your first cup of talent management whipped to perfection.
Hey, everybody, welcome to HR Latte. This is Rayanne Thorne. Thanks for joining us today. Very excited about my guest. Quick reminder, Dovetail Software sponsors HR Latte, so a big shout out to Dovetail. Thank you, Dovetail, for bringing this wonderful programming, I can say that myself, to everybody. And I am very excited to have the one and only, the venerable HR's own godfather of soul, Jerry Crispin, to the show. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning. Nice to see you, or hear you anyway, Rayanne. That's great.
Yep. It's nice to have you here. Thank you for joining me today. This is my first foray back into the world of business, if you will. I did a little bit of work while I was on my honeymoon, and I returned at midnight last night. And so I'm excited to jump right back into my work week, sitting here talking
because we're just
with
sitting
you.
Here having coffee. It's just we're a continent away from each other.
That's right. Isn't the internet and technology fantastic?
It is. It's just fascinating to me how much things have changed. And fortunately, that word venerable was probably more appropriate because I've been around for a while.
Well, and you have, like most of us, have adjusted to the times. I mean, I have been around a while as well, maybe not as quite as long as you, but a while, long enough to remember how important the fax machine was. So things have definitely changed.
Absolutely. You know, it's great. And what we acquire along the way, I think, Rayanne, is just lots of stories. So it becomes an interesting journey for sure.
So, Jerry, there may be people out there that don't know you. So I would love for you to share a little bit about yourself and tell us about your organization, Career Crossroads.
Sure. Well, the short version, I think, is that I've been a student of recruiting really my whole life. And while I graduated with an engineering degree, I rapidly spent time in graduate school learning about human resources in a lot of depth. Recruiting was something I really fell in love with. I became fascinated by it even in graduate school. Worked in career services to help myself work through all of that. And by the time I got out, I went and worked for Johnson & Johnson for 10 years. A lot of it was recruiting, but I sampled running HR in a couple of their divisions and a variety of things like that. Then went to work in, I was much more entrepreneurial and at some point moved to heading up part of a recruitment advertising company for about 10 years. And those were the days when it was really the heyday of all of that. Then Career Crossroads came. And essentially it was Mark Mailer, my business partner, and I realized that we were helping people, particularly vice presidents of HR who were out of work, find new jobs. And suddenly this weird thing called the internet was there, and we were able to leverage that. We started looking at that to help them. And I had the opportunity to then go speak at the 1996 SHRM National Conference for the first time. And the subject was HR and the Internet. And they said, if you have a book, we'll promote it. So Mark and I looked at each other and said, how hard could a book be? So believe it or not, the folks who produce books like McGraw-Hill, et cetera, all loved what we wanted to do, but they weren't going to pay us for it. So we did it ourselves, put some money together, and printed 5,000 books that were chock full with all 300 job boards that we could find on the internet and our opinion of how good they would be if you tried to use them to find a job, how, you know, useless or whatever. And that embarrassed a few people. But what happened was I gave the talk at SHRM. That's a whole different story, but it was very successful. And we sold all 5,000 books in the next day. And
what?
So Mark and I looked at each other and said, oh, there's got to be a business here. So we actually wrote that book over and over again for 8 times till 2003. And sold hundreds of thousands of copies. We're doing a lot of consulting and everything else. But we knew we had to evolve. And what I do now is probably came to be somewhere around 2002. We invited some friends to Princeton, and I guess it was 2002. And we called it a colloquium because it was a peer. The definition of colloquium is sort of a peer-to-peer platform. And we challenged folks to share what they were actually doing now as opposed to what they hoped to do someday. And we challenged them not only to share what they were proud of, but what was keeping them up at night and impacting their ability to recruit and to use the internet and other aspects of recruiting capabilities. So that started it out in 2002. And last 3 weeks ago, we were in Minneapolis with Target as the host. We have about 100 companies that participate in our colloquium. But I only want a small group, no more than like 40 to 50, in any one of the 8 meetings that I run each year. And that was the 82nd colloquium. And 3 weeks from now, we'll be in Amazon, focusing at Target. We focused on college recruiting. At Amazon, we're going to focus on analytics. And in each of these meetings, we'll have about 50 companies, between 40 and 50 companies, represented by the people who actually do that, whatever that is. So college recruiting or analytics or whatever. And that way they realize that during the course of the day and a half, they can share, they can poll each other, they can engage each other, challenge each other, et cetera. And I kind of set the stage, if you will, by creating scenarios, strange things that might happen to them that force them to kind of begin pinpointing some of the choke points in some of these issues. A lot of them obviously are technology related. And so if you will, if you think about it, I have a focus group of nearly 100 companies that that collectively hire over the course of a year about 3 million people. They're all very large companies. And it helps me better understand not where people aspire to be as much as where they actually are and where they're likely to be in the next year to 2 years, because that's where they're spending their money.
So in all of this study and in all of the work that you have done with Mark over the years, and I know that you're also instrumental in the Candidate Experience Awards, and we will get to that a little bit later on the show, do you feel, Jerry, that you have been on the right road for your career? Do you feel that this is the place you were meant to be? Have you reached the pinnacle? I know, I love that you said you're a student, and I know that you're have said that many, many times. When I first met you, it was you were presenting and talking about being a student of HR and a student of HR processes and new technology and a lifelong student. I know that you describe yourself as that. Do you feel that you've reached that place now and that you don't have more to learn, or are you still in that mode of there is so much to learn and I'm going to try to teach it?
I think you if you believe that you have, you know, gotten to the point where you're, quote, an expert or a guru or thought leader or whatever, I think you've lost it. You've already begun to lose it. So I encourage anyone who tags themselves that way to somehow change their title, because it encourages them to think that they have, quote, arrived. And the reality is, I don't think anybody does. I think anybody who's successful fully plays the hand that they've been given, you know. And some of us have, you know, a pair in our hand, and some of us have a full boat.
Yeah.
Whatever hand you happen to have, I think if you play it with the attitude that, not that you want to win, but that you already are a winner, is really what success is about. It's the journey. It's the playing of it. It's not the end of it. So I hope I never am satisfied that there isn't, that I can't play my hand, you know, that there's no more hands or whatever, that I take my money off the table. You know what I mean? It is that journey that is so extraordinarily part of who you are and what you do. So, yeah, I mean, it's
kind of that destination.
The question, though, around that is, and I learned this very early in my career, was to try to understand what kinds of things are you playing for or playing with. And I had the good fortune to get to know a guy named Dick Bowles when I was in graduate school and working on career services. I wanted to understand more about what is really a career about. What does that really mean? And I just shared this story not long ago with John Sumter. But I said, so I went to this conference with Dick Bowles, and I was expecting him to kind of teach me, and I would just write a bunch of notes. And what he did was he opened up by saying, okay, the first exercise I want you to do is write your obituary. So as a 22, 23-year-old, I had never heard this before. I mean, today a lot of people have heard this kind of exercise, but
right.
This was like a peak experience for me. I fundamentally had trouble imagining what the end would be, that what would people say about me. And what it did is it forced me to think about that in a much deeper way. It took over a week for me to come up with something that was satisfying. And I put that in my wallet and kept it in my wallet for 30 years. And the only reason I threw it away 30 years later is I pulled it out, as I typically did when I was going to do something or choose to do something. And I realized by now I had kind of incorporated all of those things in that. So I was very comfortable with it. So you got to play a hand, but you're playing it for what? You know, you're playing it for your family. You're playing it for money. You're playing it for whatever. You need to make choices about those things. There's no judgment. It's just, I do believe that we all are the kinds of people that, if we get comfortable with who we are now, get comfortable in our own skin, the earlier you can do that, the more you can then play fully the hand that you have.
You know, I did that exercise about a year ago. So I don't think it matters what age you are. I was 50 when I sat down and wrote my obituary, and it is impactful. You know, it does change your thinking, and it stops you short in your tracks, especially if you're not expecting it and you're in a group and somebody passes out paper and says, okay, write it. And then you're going to read it. You know, it's like, wait a minute. I don't, you know,
does what I'm planning to do and invest my time, energy, effort,
yes,
money, et cetera, in, does that add to that?
Right.
And if it doesn't, kind of you gotta, you know, look in the mirror.
Yeah.
Change something.
And I've developed this philosophy that whatever I do has to benefit me the industry I serve, the family that I have. It has to, there has to be some kind of benefit that comes out of it, not just a mindless activity to keep me busy, right?
I do think a lot of people seriously look at this. I think they do get up with that. They come to that conclusion.
Yeah. There has to be mindfulness in all that we do. And we, when I did this exercise, Jerry, we did it in a mortuary. You know, our group went to, on a field
trip. That's cool.
And while we're sitting in the chapel, you know, our group leader stands up and says, okay, here's, you know, my assistant is handing out a piece of paper and a pencil, and you're going to write your obituary while we're sitting in the chapel. It was you know, one of those never forgotten experiences. It never will be. They're completely unforgettable.
Right.
So thank you.
And you know, so for example, when we're talking you earlier before we started here, we're talking about my camp out, and and that really is an outgrowth of that as well. So I've been camping with my cousins. I have 19 first cousins on my mother's side, and they and I and their kids and now their kids. For the last 38 years have go away for a week together. And and everybody looks forward to it, and people fly in from all over the world to be part of that now. And people know what drives that is this underpinning of having some ability to share and impact others' lives. And that I think is a part of where a lot of people want to be.
Well, your camp out impacts me. I mean, was the first question I asked you today when we started speaking. Did you go on your trip, your family reunion trip? You know, because I love hearing that story, and I know that you do it every summer, and that it's an important part of your summer. And so I always want to hear
it. It re-energizes me, and I think it also I see the value that it provides for the children and children's children, the pride they take in that, the pride they take in their family, the pride they take in being inclusive. When I look around my family now, this extended family, which started with my grandfather, an Italian, coming to this country, is now represents maybe 20 different countries, every race, almost every religion, and every sexual orientation. So, we've become a very inclusive family that looks a lot like America.
And what a set of eyes to look outward from, right? What a way
Absolutely.
To raise your family in with these beautiful eyes that see the world through your family, right?
Well,
that's
they start to take, you know, that they. Well, the thing I'm proudest of is then that the young people are exposed to so much difference and diversity in their own family that they can't possibly do anything but embrace diversity.
Yeah. Well, they don't know any different.
Right. Exactly.
They don't know any different. So that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Thank you for sharing that story. And I want to shift gears a little bit because I want to get into a little bit more career meat here. So
sure.
Let's talk about technology, a little bit technology today. You've seen the transitions over the last several years, especially in the last 5 years, what's happened with technology in HR, in hiring. When you talk to HR professionals and you consult with them, advise them, is there anything that you've come to a conclusion with that is the most important thing an HR professional or hiring professional should remember when evaluating technology and when getting ready to make a selection? Is there something that you can share with us that they should be aware of?
Yeah, I can quickly share three things. I think the first is never forgetting the basics. I think technology needs to enable your vision, not the vision of the person who made the technology. Too often we're the slave, we end up being the slaves of the technology that drives how we work rather than what we are trying to accomplish in terms of our outcome. And so we tend to get, that's when we start becoming very bureaucratic. You gotta feed the technology. And so the first issue really is, do you have a vision of what you want to accomplish by using technology? The second is really paying attention to your audience who is using the technology that you might use. So why would you pay money for something that somebody presented to you without really spending any time talking to others like yourself who are already using it? Now, I grant you, there's a small number of people who always want to be first. So they want to cut down the trees of the forest and make the path. That's fine, but that's a small percentage of the total. Most people who are going to adopt any kind of technology need to recognize how the audience that's using it is in fact using it, whether they use it the way it was intended to, what they're doing that's differently. And you will always find unique items that help you to make better choices and better decisions. So all that investment has an extraordinary payback. And the third is to better understand who your audience that you are, who are the stakeholders in your process. If it's recruiting, you're talking about hiring managers, company leaders, right. Yourself, the people who work for you. If you're a staffing leader, the candidate. And so it's going to be important for you to absolutely understand how you can map the process of how the needs of each of the stakeholders is being met through that technology. And typically what you find is that it's unbalanced. And so you need to have whatever workaround makes sense or whatever integration you need that you need to start driving toward to ensure that you are balancing or attempting to balance the needs of all of the stakeholders, because you could be driving one of them to the other's detriment. And too often that's where we get into problems with candidates who we think we should hire, end up hiring, and then literally destroying their careers.
Yes, and
not because
so,
they can do the job, but will they want to do the job if that's not the best
right.
decision for them in their career right now?
Right. And such great things to remember. Thank you for sharing those, Jerry. And it leads right into my next question regarding candidate experience and the work that you have done around candidate experience. I think I was sitting outside in a park back in 2008 in Toronto when I first heard you discuss this topic, and I know you probably were talking about it long before that. First off, what your early work in HR was obviously around looking at job boards, you know, writing about job boards. Is this what led you to understanding candidate experience is pretty crappy out there? And it doesn't matter what kind of technology we introduce. It either technology is meant to solve a problem, but it most often, especially in recruiting and in job search, for looking at it from the candidate side, has created multiple problems, multiple layers between the job seeker and the hiring department or the HR department.
Sure.
What drove you to talk about candidate experience, to be a part of the Candies or the Candidate Experience Awards? And then tell us a little bit about that entity. Tell us about the Candies and how people can get involved.
Well, for me, it goes back to the beginning. So when I was even in graduate school, I was talking to people who are alumni coming back from my college and telling me about the experience that they were having in their career and how they were treated as employees and as candidates. And I couldn't understand that. I was too young, and I just could not imagine that people would be treated that way. And then when I was working for Johnson & Johnson early in my career, and the first time I had responsibility for recruitment, you have to understand there was no technology. So the technology was a postman would come into the office that I was in with a bag over his shoulder and dump, you know, 1,000 resumes in envelopes in a big barrel in my office. We were getting 1,000 a year. Now here, so and the reason I tell you this story is only because it then makes sense what I'm going to tell you next. So what I did, which it was not my idea, it was part of my process, was every Tuesday and Thursday, three people from local who were mentally challenged from local community organizations were driven to my offices at J&J's headquarters, and they came in and everybody loved them, and their job was to open every envelope and stack appropriately every resume in stacks that the recruiters would then look at, examine, and eventually bring back to them in stacks before the end of the day of those resumes that we were no longer going to deal with, and those same folks sent them postcards. Or if it was more sensitive, okay, and this was a final letter and we were giving them more feedback, they would then take the letter and put it in an envelope and send it out. So wow. In 1978, with 30,000 pieces of paper or, you know, sets of paper being brought in, every one of those individuals who applied received no later than monthly a status report of where they stood or a final closure note that they were no longer being considered. So if you could do that with paper and no technology, what do you think the expectation would be of a candidate today in terms of their being informed on a regular basis about their status and or closure of being hired for a job? So I've always had a thing about this mapping process for all the stakeholders and the extent to which the candidates have been dropped through that, that crack in that whole
right.
thing. And even though technology often offers some solutions to those issues, they more often than not have not been put into place because of either a fear that if we don't do it consistently, someone's going to sue us, or we just don't want to do it now, we're going to wait, that kind of thing, and then waiting never happens. So what happened was about 5 years ago, Elaine Orler, who was talking to Chris Foreman, Elaine is an active person in our space, has a great consulting operation. She called me up and she says, you know, we've been speaking about candidate experience for a long time, and we've been just beating companies up left and right and talking about all the things they do badly. Why don't we find the companies who are doing things well and describe what they're doing well and maybe help them measure whether doing it well has any impact on other things like company performance, retention of recruiters, willingness to refer, et cetera, et cetera. And I go, wow, light bulb went on. And I said, cool, it's sort of like Psych 101, let's reward positive behavior rather than beat up negative behavior, right? So we started that 5 years ago. We asked companies whether they were into it. And I will tell you that we just finished the campaign part of the Candidate Experience Awards in North America this last week. Started in March, we had about 200 companies say they wanted to participate this year, and they had to document, if you will, all of the touch points in the recruiting process where candidates, if you will, are touched and where, in fact, they might have some reaction, if you will, to that part of the experience. And then the critical piece, which started around June was, or beginning of June, was those same companies, not all of them, about 150 of them, were willing to go out to their candidate population, especially those candidates they did not hire, and ask them to follow a link to a mirror survey in which they would rate, rank, discuss, et cetera, it's pretty, it was pretty comprehensive, how they were treated when they applied for that company's job. And as of last week, when we when we closed it, 126,000 of their candidates did a 20 to 40 minute survey.
That's fantastic.
And so, and this is just North America.
Wow.
We are exploding in Europe. We now have, you know, this is all staggered. So Europe is behind where we are in North America, and they now have 100 companies registered. We launched in Australia this year, and we expect about 30 to 50 companies in total to participate, and that will be much later in the year. And I'm putting together volunteers now from South America for next year. We have about 100 volunteers fully involved. We have two full-time people now working for Talent Board, which is a nonprofit that I created with Elaine and Ed Newman. The volunteers include industry consultants and folks like yourself, and they also include about 35 multiple winners, so staffing leaders who are multiple winners of the Candidate Experience Awards over the last 5 years. The first dissertation using data from 2 years ago, which was 46,000 candidate surveys, was defended last month by staffing leader at Walmart who was working on his doctorate at the University of Arkansas. In September, the end of September, September 30th, October 1st, in Dallas, we will have a symposium. We expect 250 companies to attend, in which we're doing case studies on what we're learning from a data point of view. And we're putting a stake in the ground on those practices that will impact referral rates, whether or not people will reapply when they have the right capabilities, whether or not they will even buy your damn product, and how many people they're telling publicly when they have a good experience or when they have a bad experience. So we can now measure the dollar value of creating a world-class candidate experience and the cost to your recruitment process of screwing that up.
What is the URL where people can go to find out more?
It's a URL called Candies, C-A-N-D-E-S, not I-E-S, but so thecandies.org.
.org.
And the last,
C-A-N-D-E-S
dot org, thecandies.org.
We'll tweet that out.
Yeah, you should. We're obviously we have hundreds of downloads going on with the free data. So all the results are free. We've been raising money from sponsors who are willing to support this on an annual basis, and we think we can continue to do that for the next couple of years. And maybe we'll someday have a modest registration fee by companies. So we get the companies to, to 1,000 who participate, we would perhaps, you know, charge $100 or something like that, and, you know, to help raise the funds to make this thing work. But it's like that discussion about what do you do with the hand you play. You know, this is a way to benefit corporations by helping arm them with the with the value, if you will, of creating a recruiting process that not only handles, seeks the people that you want to hire, but also does not forget the 99 9/10% you do not hire. That has been, I think, a dangerous error in the history of how we create recruiting process that I think now is starting to be corrected. And if you look at some of the – read some of our work, you'll find examples of companies that are having extraordinary shifts in the value of their recruiting practice because they're measuring it in many cases through NPS scores. Their NPS scores are flying off the roof.
That's such great work, and thank you for your contribution. I know you've been working on this for years and years and years, and it's exciting to see the globality explode on this project.
Well, it's fun, and I want to get everybody involved. I mean, at some point, we'll you've been going to a lot of different kinds of things, but don't you're in not too due to the future, you get tapped too. So I'm really twisting a lot of arms of a lot of people in our industry to participate at least for a year or two in this effort, because I think we all should benefit by doing that, and I think we all have different eyes, if you will, to put on this subject that will help us collectively to do it well.
Well, I was raised in a recruiting office that put the candidate first, you know, so this is very near and dear to my professional heart and have written quite a great deal about the candidate experience and talked about it and having started off as a recruiter. So please tap
You're on my short list, just so you know.
So let's shift gears a little bit again and talk about HR Tech coming up. So the 18th annual HR Technology Conference and Exhibition is coming up in October. They've moved it a little bit later this year, pushing it as close as possible to the conference that will be taking place in Europe at the end of October. When you consider, and I know you're going, you are a face that everybody looks forward to seeing at this conference in particular. When you consider attending conferences like this and you consult individuals that are possibly deciding whether or not they will go, right? What should an attendee know when attending a conference like this? And is it important? Is it important for an HR professional or hiring professional, in particular those that are in the position of buying technology, to attend this conference?
It is essential. The question is, you know, who are the decision makers? And if I were a talent acquisition leader or a talent management leader, I think this would be one of two or three conferences that I would consider essential, even if the critical decision might be coming out of my HRIS or some combination of other people who are involved. I don't think that you can lead into the future without some sense of what are some of the key technologies that are out there that are impacting your function. And so I think HR Tech, especially in the United States, is as a conference, is probably one of the premier conferences that you can go to. There are others like SHRM's annual conference, for example, that have some additional or other kinds of value because of the diversity, if you will, of the focus. But the focus on technology here is really where you're going to see everything that's coming up. And if I were going, if I were advising people who not only to go, but what to do there, I think you do have to do some due diligence. I think you have to look carefully at what programs you want to watch. So you need to map out. You can't map out 10 minutes before the start of a session which session you're going to go to.
That's so important.
You might change your mind about the session you want to go to because of something you just heard. But to be honest with you, you really have to have a full map of what I'm going to do for the next 2 days in terms of learning. And I don't think you should necessarily go to every single session. I think there are a number of things that should be done within, for example, the trade show area. All of the products that you are using, you should go and see not only what is their visibility and what are they pitching, but who else, what are the alternatives out there? And so if you have some core technology that's underlining what you do, you need to see if anything is bubbling up that is promising to do, let's say, the next generation now, while your technology is still talking about that is to come maybe next year, the year after, whatever. They have gotten lazy, if you will, about continuing to evolve the quality of what they're doing, because that's a huge danger. We are in a fast-moving world, and you need to know what's there. I would also, I love one of the things that HR Tech did last year with emerging technology companies that don't have the money to to pay for the big booth.
Yeah, I love this.
And they
stuck
a group of them, like 10 of them all in one little cubicle kind of thing, and you could wander through there and go, what the hell are you got? And some of them are so embarrassingly simple, you know, like they haven't done their due diligence. They decided that this is the silver bullet for how we would recruit in the future if only every company will do it. You know, it's some of it is laughable, but some of it is, oh, really? I've never thought of it that way.
Right.
Maybe it is time to be able to collect data in this way, and it could add value to how I make decisions. So
I love the Startup Pavilion.
I find the stimulation extraordinary.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that I do. I mean, obviously, if you're active in the space and you're engaged, there are various side rooms where people are getting a little more in-depth. They're networking. If you can find or learn that there are colleagues in competitive companies or industry companies that are similar to yours, you should try to find them, seek them out, and see if you can have a nice dinner, and then ask them what the hell they're doing. I mean, you know, it's, you're learning what you learn at a session at a conference tends to be something they did a year ago and got approved by PR or legal to be able to share.
That's right.
And what you can do with a colleague in a competitive company that you admire over dinner, breaking bread, is find out what's keeping them up at night, find out what they're proud of, find out what they're spending their money on, to experiment with, that you should be aware of.
Right.
So that's kind of where I'm at with HR Tech. And, you know, I will tell you, I love to gamble. I almost never gamble when I'm in a conference in Las Vegas, because I take conferences as seriously as I take anything else. I want to be there in the moment. And when I go to a session, I watch not only the person who's speaking, but I watch the audience to see if they're getting it. I aggressively question vendors and suppliers. I think you should be fearless about that, because many of them are manned. That's probably not the right word, but manned by men and women who are salespeople. I want to know. I actually want to talk to the people who develop the product.
Right. And that's what I love seeing the technologists that end up coming to this conference. I think it's wise for an organization to bring their CTO, to bring a couple of guys that are in that back room, plugging away, improving the product, looking at the roadmap, making decisions of which area are we going to develop next. I love that part of this conference. And I think that organizations should seriously consider manning the booth with the guy that's doing the sales engineer, the guy that's the cross between the salesperson and the techie, and also a few of the techs that are developing the product. They can answer questions. They can learn about what the competition, to go back to what you just mentioned earlier, they can learn, they can talk to some of their competitors. They can find out what's on your mind. What are you guys looking at? And there's plenty of room in this industry. You know, I've found over the years for a couple of competitors in each category, right? There's plenty of room. There are plenty of clients. And why not? Competition is good for us. It's good for us to learn what's going on out there and how can we improve and not stagnate, you know? And as practitioners, we find ourselves coming to this conference like, oh, I don't know anything. You know, I can remember my first conference walking through HR Tech thinking, oh, my gosh. I had no idea, you know, that there was so much out there, so much available, so much mind power devoted to HR technology and hiring technology.
If it's the first time, finding someone like you who might have been there a couple times before as a guide is not a bad idea either. There are often after-hours interesting cocktail parties that you can get into. Yep. Where you can network a little bit more. And as you go year after year, you'll learn a lot. And if you think you have something to share, then you should start looking at how you can give back to the space by sharing that. You know,
right.
I think part of the responsibility of all of us is if we're doing something we're really proud of, how do you tell others? Nothing wrong with figuring that out. It's not going to hurt your career for sure. You know, keeping it inside the company, your company is not going to be honoring you with more and more money because you did something really cool. You're going to have to do something really cool all the time. So be cognizant of your own career, and by helping people understand what you've accomplished and you know, your comfort in that and how other people can do what you've done and even go further adds to value and I think makes you attractive potentially for upping the game in your own career.
Yeah, definitely. So Jerry, let's talk about you. I want to talk about you personally. We started off talking about you, and I want to wind back around to that. Now, when you consider your own future, being this perpetual student, this godfather of HR, if you will, when you provide services, when you talk with the client companies, when you sit down with individuals that you are trying to consult yourself, what are some things that you do in order to keep doing your job efficiently, more effectively, to find the better way to do your work?
Well, I will tell you my attitude is I have no loyalty to companies. I have loyalty to people. So I choose the people that I want to associate with. I turn down about a quarter of the people who want to pay me money, in part because I don't think that they are ready to share, or I don't think that they are willing, you know, to challenge or be challenged. And so it's not a matter of age or title or whatever. I just look for people who are excited about accomplishing something that has benefit not only for them and their company, but benefit for everybody around, willing to, you know, share that out. So, you know, the first thing is I don't surround myself with people who really need a lot of help. in getting the right attitude, I leave that for somebody else. I don't have that many days left, so that's a mission I'm not on. I'm on a mission to help the people who really care get to the next level. And three things that I always try to keep, present in my mind is to love what you do. I mean, if you're not enthusiastic about what you are doing, if you're not playing your hand to the fullest with an attitude that you're already a winner, it's very hard to wait for success. You need to be in that moment of success. You need to, if you have to fake it, fake it. But the reality is,
right,
it becomes real. And if you can't love it, then you need to go find something else to do. And that's not my mission. There are plenty of people out there who are extraordinary coaches who can help other people figure out what that would be. But you should know that if you're in recruiting and doing recruiting and you love recruiting and whatever, you will always have access to me, because those are the people I want to be with. That's why I'm still doing what I do. I think a second thing is I never lose sight of the fact that I'm a constant learner. And so one of the things that I force myself to do every year is go, and this is to step outside the box. Other people can do this different ways, but for me, I have the ability to go to different countries, live with recruiters, watch them recruit, and I do that every year. So in past years, I've been in Argentina and Buenos Aires, actually living for 2 weeks with recruiters and going to work with them every day and watching them. You may think that's boring. I find that really exciting. And I've done it in Japan, in Israel, in India, China, just a whole bunch of countries, and I'll continue doing that. And it keeps me focused. It keeps me engaged. I love to think about how culture plays such an interesting impact. So you got to find ways to be the student as much as you possibly can. And then you continue to act as a kind of a world-class student, and that's the whole purpose. And I think the last is always, you got to be in the moment and listen to people fully. You have to be present when people are telling you something. And I don't care if you've heard it 30 times. You gotta be present to it.
We learn by repetition, right?
And what that means, and it tells you so much about whether the industry is moving or moving fast or moving slowly. If you only pay attention to the cool kids, you're going to have a whole different world of perception than if you try to pay attention to the where you are. And if you're at a conference and you're engaged in a session, being fully present in that session, not doing all kinds of multitasking, but fully examining what's going on right here, right now. So I turn off. I tell people who need to call me or want to call me that if I'm at a conference, I turn everything off during the course of the day.
Right.
You cannot reach me.
That's how I am.
And that's maybe old school, but I got to tell you, I find it. Let me say it this way: when I have a colloquium meeting, in the first hour, people who've never been to one of my meetings will surreptitiously pull out their smartphone to check whether or not they get any important messages. Within about 2 hours, people are calling their office saying, "I'm turning this thing off. Don't bother me."
Right.
Because they get that the experience of being present when you're in a small group of eight people, let's say, because I set up tables six to eight people, and you are intensely talking about things that are important to you, you don't have room for trying to multitask with a dozen other things out
nope.
there.
Oh, that's such great advice.
So those are things that I, encourage people to give thought about. There are times you can't do it, There are times when your job forces you to do certain kinds of things. I get that.
But
I do think
be
present the things
that
are important to do.
Yeah. I think it's important to have boundaries, right? Because I mean, I just came back from a delayed honeymoon, and there, you know, 2 hours every morning I just spent going through my email and checking things, and it's part of who I am. I need to be in touch. Then I can let go. If I don't do that, then I feel like I can't concentrate and relax. Concentrate to relax. That's the type of person that I am. I have to concentrate in order to relax, not the other way around. So, such great advice, Jerry. And I want to thank you so much for being here on HR Latte. Before we get to my favorite part of the show, any last words of wisdom you can share with the listeners?
I think I just did the exhausted what I've got for you. In relation to that, I think the most important thing that I'm a fan of, and the reason why I'm at 68, I'm still enthusiastic about the future of recruiting and have no, you know, plans to retire, even though I could. It's just such a, you know, a great space with great people. And for me, I think it's important to find a way of looking at your job that helps you see how you're meeting your career and life goals. And I think if you're fully embedded and fully aligned with how you give back, you mentioned it earlier, balance. That issue of balance,
right.
We have. You know, we have the ability to make some money. We have the ability to help other people. We have the ability to engage our family. So all the different parts of your life, if you can find a way to put them in balance, you're really operating in a zone. And it's not about being better. It's about being the best you can be, and I'm just a fan of striving for that.
That's wonderful. I love that. So now, Jerry, I don't know if you've heard about this part of the show, but this is myself. I call it my selfish part of the show. It gives me an opportunity to be the student a little bit further and learn about new places to go, new books to read, and so forth. So I call this my quick hit fave section. So I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions. If you could share with us some favorites of your own. What is your favorite food?
Cuban, Italian. Boy, I am such a foodie. It's hard for me. Italian would have to be my base. And I love cooking a variety of Italian dishes. But the one that I almost always go with as a standard that I try to go and find anything that's as good as what I can do is pasta puttanesca, which is a fresh sauce. Let's put it that way.
Incredible.
You'd have to look it up. Yeah, so that's
I will definitely look that up.
Yes,
I'll have to have you email me the spelling of that.
puttanesca is actually, it means whore's sauce. And
wow, okay.
So yes, and it basically in between Johns, the prostitutes would create a very fast, fresh sauce that, you know, satisfied.
Puttanesca, so, I love that.
It has capers. It has a whole variety of different, I would say, vinegary kind of things in it. But I think it's hard to make well, and different variations I appreciate, but I happen to like mine best, so I keep looking for that. I could talk about a lot of it for sure.
I love that. And I will be emailing you later about that, but I don't think I'll forget the title now. Thank you for the explanation. your favorite book? This could be something that's had a huge impact on your life, something that you're reading now, something new. Whatever you want to share with us.
There is a book I mentioned not too long ago about Escher. Goodell and Bach. Won a Pulitzer Prize many years ago, probably 1980s. The bottom line of that book, which is extremely difficult to read, so I didn't even know why I was getting into it, and then didn't know why I continued to try to understand it, because it was beyond me. I was constantly frustrated with the fact that there were levels of meaning in the book that I only recognized that they were there. I didn't quite recognize what they were, you know. So it was very frustrating for someone who thinks they're smart to realize how much smarter there is.
Other people,
you know, I mean, it's like your intelligence. My IQ just went down to, you know, a very low number, and relative to what I was reading. But the fundamental part of that was, again, it's about being in the moment. It's about recognizing that in everything there are common elements. So across music, mathematics, and art, for example, there were layers of understanding about who we are and what we are that cross all of these boundaries. And so whatever boundary you're in, whatever function, whatever silo exists, there are themes that become common across all of those. And teasing some of that out is a way to handle conflict, is a way to appreciate others, is a way to, you know, so there was this kind of sense around some of that has probably been one of the more interesting pieces. And I, you know, other than that, I read a lot of science fiction that, you know, I can gobble up in a couple of days. So whatever's current. I'm reading a book called Collision.
Ah. And is that a novel?
Yeah, it's a novel about written by one of the previous defense leaders in the United States it's a science fiction book about asteroids and the potential for catastrophic disaster, if you will. It's a civilization
wow.
killer.
Wow.
not
a zombie apocalypse or anything like that, huh?
No, that gets into fantasy to me. I like science fiction. I like somebody to tell me that there's some numbers that we can generate that
potential
suggest that it's possible.
Right.
So, you know,
I love
Isaac Asimov's I, a Robot could still be read, you know, 60 years after he wrote it, 70 years after he wrote it. Simply because we're talking about, again, the issue of the impact of automation and robotics.
Right. We're still talking about it, still fascinated about it. I, those are the scary books or movies to me, the ones that actually have the potential of truly happening, right? That's scary. What's your favorite place in the world? This could be your own
home. New Orleans,
really? The
Without
food, the music, the atmosphere, all of it?
The attitude.
Love it.
There's a term used in New Orleans called lagniappe. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but it's L-A-N-G, I think. I-A-P-P-E, something like that is how it's spelled. And I think there's different spellings for it as well. But but essentially it means something extra. And there's this attitude of joy of engaging you as a customer and not only satisfying what you want, but then giving you something extra, something unexpected, something you didn't expect, whether it be in food or in a trinket or in just the, you know, the joy of engaging, two people engaging. So I love that kind of attitude that you see throughout. I love the food. I've learned... one of my favorite people down there, Preston Edwards, is a hero of mine. He He is actually was heavily involved in civil rights. His wife is a civil rights lawyer. He started a company called the Black Collegian magazine about 40 years ago. I lived in New Orleans all his life. I typically go down there. I try to see him or have dinner with him and his wife. Right. And they've been there many generations, actually, their families. And I stayed with him for a couple extra days, and his wife taught me how to make gumbo properly. So I can make an extraordinary roux, and I can make a fabulous gumbo.
Wonderful.
I learned from natives how to do that.
I love that. And last but not least on my quick hit save list is, what's your favorite thing to do?
Favorite thing to do?
Yeah.
Well, camping. Annually I go camping. That is my energizer. I mean, I would camp more if I were a little younger. But the week that I go camping with my cousins is fundamentally the most important thing to me. So that's how I maintain my relationship with the ground, if you will. I am fully grounded when I go do that.
Jerry, it has been, of course, an absolute pleasure to have you on HR Latte. Finally, thank you for joining me today. And I look forward to seeing you in October at the HR Tech Conference in Vegas. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Folks, thanks for tuning in today. We'll be back next week. I'll be speaking with Jay Coons as we hit off the healthcare HR Today series. Thanks so much. We'll talk with you soon.